Hi, I'm Allison Pease, Associate to the Provost for Faculty. This spring, John Jay is awarding the Distinguished Teaching Prize to three extraordinary professors whose work inside the classroom deserves recognition. To celebrate the dedication of these individuals and to learn a little bit about what great teaching looks like, I'm sitting down with each of them to ask them about winning the prize and teaching life at John Jay. Today, I have the honor of talking to Rob Fonts, Adjunct Assistant Professor of English and Gender Studies. Rob has been teaching at John Jay since 2013 and has taught 10 different courses in gender studies and literature. I begin the interview by asking him what winning the Distinguished Teaching Prize means to him.
I'm humbled and honored by it, but I got to tell you, it was terrifying to hear it. Because each person who gets in front of a classroom feels that pang of, am I right up here? Do I know what I'm doing? There's this terror when you start. And there's this feeling in which, oh, are other people better at it than me? And it creates this false hierarchy because we all are the sum of our experiences. If we had given up our first year teaching because we just listened to our own failures, no one would be teaching anymore. So I am humbled by this and I'm strengthened by it, but I also don't want anybody to think that's because we should all be just bowing down and listening to people who are judged and awarded and rewarded accordingly. We all need to just continue to be collaborative and to learn from each other, because that's ultimately how we continue in this and how this profession continues to thrive, is when we as faculty listen to each other and hang out. If we could get back to the 5-day-a-week model and weekly faculty meetings, wouldn't that be just swell? Even if it's just to hang out and talk about, you know, random acts of learning and small things we can do in the classroom. Maybe I'm being a little bit sentimental about the whole thing. I thought of my mother, who was an actress in high school, who actually won an award for her light comedy sophomore year, and then had to stop because of family change, and she had to go to work on an assembly line, and she could do no extracurriculars. And I'm reminded of it because when I think about my own teaching, when I've written and think about, I know that I incorporate elements of my parents, both of whom did light comedy really well and could improvise and were comfortable on stage, which I never thought of until the second day in the classroom when I realized that I was improvising and that I was deadpanning and going off script. And I realize that we bring those elements to the classroom, but particularly here at John Jay, we have students who have quit what they loved because they had to do what they needed to do to survive. And they're often sacrificing to come back here. So when I heard about this, I was chastened by the fact that I'm most proud, not just as an adjunct to win this prize or as somebody who feels like they care about teaching, but also because it's at John Jay, a place that I adore, not just because of the faculty who are amazeballs, but because I have students who do what they need to do to be here. And I've come from that, from those grounds, but even we all bring different antecedents and different burdens, and if they're willing to work, I'll work with them. And it's so, I'm going to get verklempt a little bit if I keep talking about this. I'm really proud that it's the John Jay Distinguished Teaching Award.
You were a student of the preeminent queer theorist, Eve Kosofsky Sedgwick. Can you tell me how you were affected by her teaching?
For Eve, it was about love. You know, her work was her love, and love was her work. And I've caught into that quite a bit, that I love going into the office. I don't necessarily love getting up in the morning, but by the time the coffee is kicked in and I'm with my students, I'm on stage and I feel amazing and ready to share information and ready to create moments with students that they'll remember, that they'll learn from. And Eve was certainly like that. You know, this was one of the two people who created queer theory. I mean, she revolutionized the industry, and yet she was such a soft person, such a gentle soul. And I think that really, I don't mention those things lightly, that this, that you can have such intellectual heft and fearlessness and yet still be gentle, gazelle-like in your movements, but nonetheless a soft, gentle human being. And I find that helps me so much in the classroom to be sympathetic, empathetic, and nonetheless intellectually spry, anticipatory, to recognize that when a student is struggling and perhaps trying to work me, that there's probably some psychological underpinning behind it, something they've learned previously, and that if I can help them unlearn that, that it may very well help them get the work done they need to get done with me, or take the extension and learn best practices for asking, you know, instead of making up that their fifth grandfather has died that semester, that maybe they just need to actually not just take work seriously, but take me seriously, even if I am also gentle and loving and thinking about my class as not just something I'm passionate about, but something that I love, a love that comes through to students. And it's tricky because we live in a world where people are taught to take advantage of each other, and that people can succeed by working on the backs of other people. And so we're taught, a lot of us, to erect barriers between us and to gird ourselves with armor. And I find, and it's taken me a long time to get here, that I don't like putting on armor in front of my class. I want to be me as fully as possible and give them the best teaching experience possible, my students, when I am fully engaged and fully invested. But it leaves me vulnerable, and Eve was vulnerable. And I think that what I have to remember is you can still be strong, like a reed. You can bend, and you can be flexible with that, but you stay a reed. You don't break. You constantly, you know, that becomes a sort of a vertebrae that has shocking motility, but nonetheless is erect. And I think that that is the greatest lesson I learned from her. Don't be afraid to show your soul, to share tea with your students, to be capacious with your love, because love is not just romantic or physical, but it is also about the way we can approach and embrace the world around us. But I know that every semester I fully give myself to my students, and that I hope every one of them got something from me that they can know that then if they're asked in the hallway, they're going to say something about me, not just he's nice, but also I learned, or it changed my way of thinking. Not he changed my way of thinking, but the class did. Because that ultimately, you pick material and you hope that students are going to respond to it and grow from it. And I want to be a good shepherd and hopefully create a loving, safe space to do it, but one that doesn't bend.
You were nominated by three students, and they each had wonderful things to say about you as a teacher. What comes across in their comments is that you show the students a lot of intellectual respect. One student calls your teaching intellectually liberating. That's pretty high praise. This student says that you don't try and lecture or indoctrinate students, but instead you promote the free flow of thought and information between students. Can you tell me what a typical Rob Fonts class period looks like?
You know, it does depend on the course, because I find some classes actually ask to be lectured to. They want some level of being provided with information. And so I find as I'm designing accordingly, it's not my preference. I'd much rather not tell. I don't need to do that. I'd much rather show you how to think it for yourself. I like courses that use multimodal design so that, you know, there may be a small lecture at the beginning of a course sequence while students are beginning to do a reading, but in which they're being assigned a group presentation and a paper that's specific for that group, so that each group becomes its own de facto study group. So time is assigned usually during the course with shorter assignments within the groups, which then get presented to the class, which ends up fomenting class discussion because each group has to talk in low-stake ways that prepares them for the high-stakes presentation and the higher stakes of the paper that they're all working on together in this de facto study group, and they're getting to know each other. Some of them hate each other. It's group work. It happens. But even then, there's a learning experience from that. Meanwhile, I'm this spectral figure, so that I somehow, despite the fact that there are sometimes classes where I've not lectured at all, I floated around the room listening, occasionally piping in, giving this sense in which that they feel safe to express to each other that they're going to get the feedback they need if they have a question about semantics or, I taught a course last semester that dealt with post-colonialism, and none of the students had ever coped with it before. And it was something that many of them caught into in a really strong, exciting kind of way. So I'm, summarizing Fanon and Foucault in 20 and 30 second bursts, which is not really doable, but giving them the little chunks that they needed to let it blossom for themselves. And I think at least two students that semester told me that they were reading outside the course because they were so excited and invigorated by post-colonialism. That you don't get that every semester. You can't. This is where you have to respect the students as individuals. You don't know who's coming to your class, and so you've got to start shaping accordingly. I find that designing courses like that, which most of my classes do, incorporating that design with writing, with group work, with smaller group work and smaller low-stakes writing assignments within these courses, whether they're a writing course or not, which most of my classes are not, give students voice, that even at the micro level in a group of four or five, they're getting a chance to talk, and in a way that they don't feel like it's potentially invalidating. Not that a classroom should ever make them feel invalidated, but students worry that they're giving a wrong answer, and I'm air quoting wrong, but they don't feel somehow that they're wrong if they're speaking to their peers. So me floating, not formally intervening into the groups, but floating allows them to continue to have that safety. But all of that starts with having to trust me, and that means I've got to be me for them. And I think that's the strongest advice I could give anybody. You've got to start being yourself. If you hate teaching, it's going to come through. And if you hate yourself, it's going to come through. But if you love the material, that shines. And if you care about students and care about lives, care about people, it starts shining through. So I will just let it all air out. If I had a bad subway ride, that'll be my 30-second intro to the day. It doesn't cost that much in class, but it makes you human. It makes you peer with them. And at some point, you have, there is a distinction between being the teacher and the student, the professor and the student. But you're also all, white blood cells and red blood cells flowing forth, and you all have the same subway experiences. It helps to create this way in which you are creating sameness, and somehow that sameness seems to, at least for me, create situations where students feel safe in my class and trust me when I ask them to leap out windows and work on assignments that don't necessarily make sense to them up front, when they're confronted with intersectionality and they have no idea what it means to them, when in fact it means everything to them. So rather than indoctrinate them with that, I've got to let them see it and hold a mirror up to them. And if they're feeling good about that class, they let me hold the mirror for them.
I want to talk about scaffolding. Scaffolding is one of those buzzwords that everybody talks about, and it's not clear that everybody really knows how to do it. For professors at John Jay who are concerned about the quality of the writing that they're getting in their assignments and may want to learn how to do better scaffolding, I would say that the materials you presented to the group, showed a lot of very thoughtful in-class and out-of-class assignments that scaffolded towards a formal writing assignment. Can you tell us what your approach to scaffolding is?
I mean, I think you want to be thinking, it's funny, you want to respect students and assume that they have intellectual worth and care about the material when they come in. But you also need to make presumptions that maybe they haven't been given the tools they need to be in your class. You know, and I think we find that when I teach 300 level lit classes, I get students who sometimes don't know how to write a proper works cited page. And you're thinking, how did they get here? But rather than kvetch about that, I've got to think of ways to integrate it into the course to anticipate, first off, for those, they're a small minority, but they are there, to anticipate for them, as well as to continue to create value for the students who are taking the class at the high level. So scaffolding assignments really helps to start identifying students who need extra help, because you're getting in low stakes ways opportunities to see when students are you know, not sure how to write an annotated bibliography because they don't even know how to write a bibliography, then you have identified up front a major concern when they're going to have a 7-page paper maybe due at the end of the semester. So I think faculty in other disciplines, perhaps outside of, say, comp lit English and other humanities assignments that do that a lot, can be thinking about that. An annotated bibliography is a prime example of that. When you have a paper due, have students write a bibliography early. A, it proves they're doing research, but B, it's giving you an opportunity to identify the students' creativity and analytic skills and how they read these sources. And also, if there's some basic skills in arrearage, let's say, they can hit the writing center at your behest well in advance of the paper being due. So instead of playing makeup, students who actually want to do better, and most of our students, all of our students want to do better, they'll take you up on it in a way that doesn't feel judged or punitive.
They say the mark of expertise is in knowing exactly how inexpert you are. What do you want to get better at?
See, you just answered the question for me, because I feel like I'm constantly still a beginner and still a learner every semester. And that's a cliche, but it's right. New students walk in, and we love to think that they know our reputation. They've looked us up. And occasionally that happens. A student will tell me, oh, I've taken a class. A friend of mine took your class and loved it. But even that, all that says is somebody liked your class. You know, unless somebody walks in and says, I love your methodology and pedagogy. And I got to tell you, that doesn't happen at the undergraduate level. It just does. Even your best and brightest at most have just heard in the hallway, oh, they like you. That sort of. So really, it's a constant evolution to take the best practices. You know, listening to other faculty helps. I think the Teaching and Learning Center is helping people get together across disciplines so that you're getting idea. I love hearing the math and the science faculty come to the events, for instance, because as somebody who was a math guy in high school, I can relate to how the thought processes are going. And I love being able to talk with people across discipline and share, not inculcate, but share and hear back, because I get ideas from that. There's sometimes, especially about form and about rightness, you know, in algebra, you can come up with the right answer. And sometimes there's more than one right answer, but there's often right answers. The students are learning that in a lot of their curriculum. They're expecting right answers. And being reminded of that and being reminded of the alternate ways to get to right answers helps me to be more assertive in telling students that there isn't always a right answer in the humanities, but that shouldn't invalidate when you find one, that they exist. It's just that sometimes, you know, I had a student once write a beautiful paper about a poem of Sappho's, which started with the posit that the book had misgendered Sappho, because clearly this poem had been written by a man to a woman because of how great the romantic love was in it. I mean, at its fundamental core, that is a misreading, but it was a fantastic misreading, not just because it made such a fundamental mistake, but the reading of the poem was actually first rate, and the student had to give a presentation on it, and I let it go. And I didn't know what to make, because I didn't want to humiliate the student, but I also thought this is a really strong presentation and opens up discussion. What I worked on was trying to make sure that she felt nurtured in that moment, that there's strength in learning from a mistake like that, especially when I can underscore just how great the rest of the reading was. every semester I'm reminded of that, that no matter what kind of habits we get into, how many excuses we've heard for the fifth time, every now and then that student's apartment really did burn down. And so it reminds me to take a step back, to breathe. I want to keep getting better at those kinds of things, remembering that each student, they start blurring for us over time. Although I see them in the hall and I'll remember the name. I usually remember something. Sometimes it's the totem animal. Sometimes it's a turn of phrase in the paper. Sometimes that comes to me before a name, which is always embarrassing. But the key is that they become new people for you every semester. There's always a new crop of students who want to learn from you and who don't know if you've won some award or not. They just want to know what intersectionality is, or, you know, I'm confused by Paul Auster's City of Glass, and what does postmodernism mean and how does it influence my life? You know, the excitement of one semester is not guaranteed for the next. And so that's constantly worth remembering and working with, and feeling inexpert, you know, your question answered it for me, I think is the way to be. It's constantly feeling like there's more to do and more to learn. Something we learned, I was real blessed to do my practicum here with Mark Macbeth, who is still giving sage advice around the department. But it always starts around this, gird yourself with the best material and then work from within. And, you know, John Jay certainly seems to encourage that in its faculty, which I adore.
So one of the books that I read lately is called Small Teaching. And the premise is that most of us who have been teaching for a while probably aren't going to radically change our teaching practices, but that there are small little things you can do and adjustments that will improve student learning outcomes. Do you have any small teaching wisdom that you could share with people? One little thing that you do that you think actually does make a difference with your students?
You know, I'm going to go back to Eve Sedgwick on this, because this is her idea, not mine. She required in her graduate seminars that you had to speak at least once every class. And I don't force that issue if I have a 36-person seminar, because that's way too many voices to try to get. It turns into, you know, a line at the deli where everyone's grabbing a number. But even in a course of that size, I require that there's always online course material, you know, where classes run on Blackboard via discussion board, and everyone must post at least 8 times those days. Every one of those classes, when I teach a seminar, each student must lead discussion once. Ultimately, I'm really leading discussion, but the student must send me materials in advance with a certain amount of questions that I will, you know, respond to, and that they start the questioning. I end up Jerry Springer moderating those classes, but the student must provide. Often they overlap with what I would have done anyways, but it forces students to take responsibility for developing their own voice. The shyer students who don't want to speak in class will still get to use Blackboard and really blow it out there. They do. They talk and talk and talk without having to worry about somebody hearing their physical voice. But it means that every student has to take ownership at least once to not just know the material, but to know it well enough that they can ask questions about it. In the smaller classes, I have actually pushed this issue of speak at least once in every class. I really think it's valuable because it forces, there's a terror in it, you know, certainly, especially for those who don't like speaking. But it forces students to take ownership of their experience. And it's interesting because we're in this customer service moment where students feel like customers, they're getting value for. So why not actually force them to take value in that? If we're going to work with that model, speaking of an evolving, you know, moment in the academy, then why not actually force them to be consumers who maximize?
Rob Fonce, John Jay's Distinguished Teaching Prize winner 2017, thank you.
It was my pleasure.